Got a few up here. Got maybe a couple. Good.
That's going to Jerry behind you as well.
I didn't print out a syllabus, but for the first 13 sessions at least, we're going by the book. So it's laid out in 13 lessons. We're going to cover it lesson by lesson. So if you miss one, you know where we'll be at. After that,
I'll have to date mine.
If you need to date it, date it. We're starting today in lesson one. So Wednesday we'll cover lesson two, the next Sunday lesson three, and so forth. After that, we'll do a couple of lessons on intertestamental history, which we'll go with Daniel, and then we'll go into Ecclesiastes, and then finally Song of Solomon. So it's not just Daniel for the whole quarter. Daniel is half of the quarter. If you look at the book, you'll see that Robert starts off with the meaning of the name Daniel. The name Daniel means God is my judge. And it's useful to point out that in the name Daniel, it ends with EL. Hebrew word for God is Elohim, which is plural, or El for short. So all these words like Daniel and Ezekiel that end in EL have the name of God in them. So God is my judge. Daniel was a man of deep and abiding faith, and we'll see that as we get into the book. The first lesson is really an introduction because we want you to understand the political and religious environment of Daniel before we get into the book, because I think you'll appreciate what he has to say more once you understand the environment in which it was, in which the events occurred. The date of his work. Well, let's look at the Old Testament prophets in general. One of the things that you see when you look at a chart of the prophets is that God sent his prophets daily, rising up early, diligently, to turn his people back to him. You see them scattered throughout history. And these are not all the prophets. These are merely the ones that wrote. This is the ones that we have the records of what they said. There were other prophets. Another striking thing that you see when you look at this is there's kind of a stack up right here in the middle where there's several all at the same time. That's pretty key because that's a significant point in time. 721, you see a stack up as well. Why? That's when the northern 10 tribes went into captivity and God worked really hard to turn them from that. And so it was that in 606, Judah is conquered first by Babylon. And that's again why you see a stack up of the prophets there. And then again in 586 is the destruction of Jerusalem. 536 is the return. And then 520, the temple is rebuilt. 457, Ezra goes to Jerusalem. And 444, Nehemiah rebuilds the wall. Those are some good dates to keep in mind. Robert lists several of these dates in his workbook and says, hey, you ought to memorize these. And you ought to, because it'll help you in your study. 606 is a key date. 586, when the temple was destroyed, a key date. 457, when Ezra goes to Jerusalem and part of the rebuilding process, is a key date. And we'll see that as we get into the book of Daniel, just how key they are. If you look at our point in time that we're talking about, that is of Daniel, you're going to see some things that are interesting in that. The time of Jeremiah, the time of Daniel, and the time of Ezekiel all have a significant overlap. They were all prophesying during the same general time period. Jeremiah starts his prophecy in the 13th year of Josiah. What's significant about Josiah? What happened during the reign of Josiah?
Brought them back to worshiping God in the right way.
Okay. He was a king of great reform. He tore down the high places. A very significant event. Jeremiah started prophesying in the 13th year. In the 18th year, where that blue triangle is the time where it ends part of Josiah's reforms and the temple was renovated. They actually found the book of the law. It had been lost because of the idolatry that had occurred. And so there's Jeremiah preaching and they find the book of the law. Must have been exciting times. Because what Jeremiah was talking about is what they found in the book of the law when they read it. And the hearts of the people were turned. But after Josiah passed, things went back to what they had been. And there's Jeremiah with the same message, but the reception is a bit different. So, some religious reforms were occurring during the time of Josiah. Politically, when Josiah dies, is when there's this regional power grab. There's Babylon that has really taken over from Assyria during the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, right? So Babylon is waging strong. Assyria is struggling. And Egypt is worried because they're all going to come south. And so Assyria sends to Egypt and says, "Help me." And Pharaoh Necho comes up. Josiah goes out against him and is defeated and dies. And so Josiah passes from the scene. Jehoahaz is set on the throne. He's not the one that you might expect, but the people made him ruler. He was the youngest son. Pharaoh deposed him. He was pro-Babylon, I read somewhere. Pharaoh deposed him and took him into Egypt and set a puppet king, Jehoiakim, his brother, another son of Josiah. So now Jehoiakim is paying heavy tribute to Egypt. This is a major change in the affairs of Judah. Judah has been independent all this time. And now Egypt has sway. They have set who the king is, and Judah's paying heavy tribute to Egypt. It's not long before Nebuchadnezzar comes along and makes him his vassal king. And he rebels. And that leads to the 606 date. Jerusalem's taken. And Jehoiakim is led in fetters or bonds back to Babylon. Babylon eventually puts him back on the throne, but he's now Nebuchadnezzar's man. He's been humiliated, and he knows that he cannot rule except through the power of Babylon. Significant date because what happens in 606? When the captivity occurs, who do they take into captivity? They take the nobles, and Daniel's one of them. And so in Daniel 1:1, you see in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, that's when he begins his discourse. Here's what happens. He's going as part of the first round of captivity. Well, Jehoiakim is allowed to live out his life. He dies. Jehoiachin, or Coniah in Jeremiah, begins to reign. Reigns 3 months. And Nebuchadnezzar pulls him off the throne and put Zedekiah in his place. So at this point, Babylon really has total control. He rebels, and in 597, Jerusalem is swept through again. And now they take what's left of the nobles, and they take all the craftsmen, all the people that can build weapons of war, all those that can do anything to help create a rebellion. They just take them. And so there's a big exodus at that point. And so when you look at Ezekiel, you'll see chapter 1, verse 2, on the fifth day of the month, which was in the month of the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, he's riding at the river Kibar. So apparently he was taken as part of the second round in 597. And then in 586, of course, Jerusalem is burned. So there's the political power play. Jerusalem is worried about Nebuchadnezzar for good reason. Over and over again, they sought help from Egypt. But by this time, Egypt wasn't playing at all in this region because Nebuchadnezzar had taken everything down to the river of Egypt, you know, the Sinai region, everything up to the edge of Egypt, Babylon owned. So trusting in Egypt was a worthless thing at that point. So you've got Jeremiah prophesying and saying, "Don't trust in Egypt." And then you've got a little bit later, Ezekiel saying the same thing, and Daniel is right there in the capital city of Babylon. So where are they at? Jeremiah's back in Jerusalem. Actually, his hometown is Anathoth, but he's going in and out of Jerusalem, and eventually he's going to stay in Jerusalem. Daniel is over in the capital of Babylon, and when Babylon is taken, he goes to the capital of the Persian Empire, in Susa. Ezekiel, he's among the exiles. And so those that were taken out of the second takeover, the craftsmen, the farmers, all that, they're sitting here by a drainage canal. It's what archaeologists believe the river Kibar was, a drainage canal feeding into the river Euphrates, and it was for irrigation for farming. So he's among the poor that are left. Any female prophets? All these that we got are literary or males. Does anybody remember any female prophets? You know, sometimes I think we get the focus that, well, all the prophets were male. But it's not really true. Can you name any of them?
Well, there's the ones that were in the Exodus. They're not mentioned by name, but the women were prophesying.
That would be probably Miriam in Exodus 15. Miriam, the prophetess. She had a great song that's really good to read about the victory, attributing to God praises for what he had done. And then, of course, we can't fail to remember in the Judges, Deborah. Yeah. And at that point, we kind of forget. But there were others. A significant one, Huldah. Why is he significant? Well, when they found the book of the law of the Lord and the temple renovations during the reign of Josiah, you might think, well, Jeremiah's right there. They would go and talk to Jeremiah about, look what we found. What should we do? They didn't go to Jeremiah. Jeremiah was living in Anathoth a few miles away. That may have been the reason. They went to Huldah. Why? Huldah lived in Jerusalem. She was a prophetess. And they asked her, what should we do? And she said the same thing Jeremiah would have. God has prophesied many judgments against the city because of what you have done. Repent. Huldah the prophetess. There was Anna in the New Testament. She was daily serving in the temple as a witness and a prophetess. And the daughters of Philip, four virgin daughters who were prophetesses, who prophesied. So let's don't forget the women. They're important. They didn't write, but that doesn't make them less important. There were also some non-literary prophets during Jeremiah's time. Huldah was one of them. Uriah was another. He's significant because Jeremiah, if you read Jeremiah, and we did a couple of quarters ago, he was concerned about his life with good reason. There was a man who prophesied in the name of the Lord, Urijah, the son of Shemaiah of Kirjath-Jearim, who prophesied against the city and against the land according to all the words of Jeremiah, had the same message. And when Jehoiakim the king, with all his mighty men and all the princes, heard his words, the king wanted to put him to death. But when Urijah heard it, he was afraid and fled and went to Egypt. And so Jehoiakim the king sent men to Egypt, and they brought him back, and they killed him. Yeah, not literary prophets. Interesting, the same message of Jeremiah. Jeremiah had reason to fear because of the people, the king especially. Worship during Jeremiah's time. And why am I focusing on Jeremiah? Remember, it was during his time that Daniel goes into captivity. This is context for Daniel. What were the people like in Jerusalem when Daniel was taken away? Well, some of the things that Jeremiah had to say, such as, if you thoroughly execute judgment between a man and his neighbor, if you oppress not the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and shed not innocent blood, nor walk after other gods, then, so this is a challenge. Why did he say that? Because that's what they were doing. Innocent blood was being shed, murder, idolatry, oppression, were the two great commandments of the law, according to Jesus. If you ask Jesus what was the greatest commandment, what would he say? Love the Lord your God with all your heart and mind, soul. And what's the second like unto it? Love your neighbor as yourself. On those two things hang the whole law. Look at these complaints. You're not following God. You're following after idols. You're oppressing your fellow man. You're perverting justice. You're not loving your neighbor as yourself. All these things. That's the situation. According to the number of your cities were your gods in Jeremiah 11:13. So they weren't just going after Baal. They weren't just going after Molech. They weren't just going after Chemosh. According to the number of your cities were your gods. And according to the number of streets in Jerusalem, you set up altars. Altars to burn incense. They built the high places to Baal and burned their sons with fire, burnt offerings to Baal. Human sacrifice, which God didn't command. He didn't want. And how did they respond? Even after the city fell, and Jeremiah had been telling them all along why the city would fail, and Jeremiah said, don't go down to Egypt. And they said, well, we will certainly do what has gone out of our own mouth. We will go to Egypt. And we will burn incense to the Queen of Heaven and pour out drink offerings to her, as we have done, we and our fathers, our kings and our princes, for then we had plenty of food. We were well off and we saw no trouble. This is the attitude of the people. Even after the city fell. Kind of sounds like today to me. People feel like they can run around and be wicked, and you know what? I'm doing pretty good. I'm making money, you know, and I'm living good. You know, I'm going to keep doing it. God doesn't care. He doesn't see. It's short-sighted. But this is the attitude. See, quite a different attitude when we get into the book of Daniel, but this is the context from which he came. Ezekiel is by the river Kibar. He's sitting with the elders of the people, and he's describing in vision what he sees in Jerusalem just before the fall. And he said to me, son of man, lift up your eyes now toward the north. I lifted up my eyes toward the north, and there, north of the altar gate, was this image of jealousy. Yeah, the altar, the idols were set up everywhere, including the temple region. You want to provoke God? Set up an image and set it up in his temple. Yeah, that's going to provoke him to jealousy. Furthermore, he said, son of man, do you see what they are doing, the great abominations, to make me go far away from my sanctuary? So I went and saw, and there every sort of creeping thing, abominable beast, and all the idols of the house of Israel portrayed all around the walls. They decorated the walls of the temple chambers with these idol gods. And he saw 70 men of the elders. It's not just the people doing this, it's the leaders. And each had a censer in his hand, a thick cloud of incense burning to these idol gods. And he said, son of man, have you seen what the elders did in the dark? They said, the Lord does not see us, but the Lord has forsaken the land. In other words, he doesn't care. We can do whatever we want. And isn't that what people do today? The Lord doesn't see. The Lord doesn't know. I can do whatever I want. There's no judgment, in other words. And it's not just the leaders. It's not just the elders. It's not just the temple. He brought me to the door of the north gate of the Lord's house, and women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. And he brought me to the inner court of the Lord's house, and there between the porch and the altar were 25 men with their backs to the temple and their faces toward the east, and they were worshiping the sun. If you look at what happened to Judah and you view it as, well, they went after idols, they did bad things, God punished them. If that's all you see, you have missed the picture. There is far more going on here. It's a much bigger picture. God has a controversy with the nations. Why? Well, look at, here's some quotes from A.H. Sace's book, Assyria as Princes, as Priests and People. They believed in this triad, Anu, Molje, and Ea. So this is kind of a background in the idol worship, and I want to show you why that's relevant. Merodach, or Bel, B-E-L, and what was the name of Daniel given to him? First three letters of his name was B-E-L. Where'd that come from? This idol god. because when he was taken into captivity, he was given a name to glorify their gods instead of the one true God. Merodach was the chief god. He was among the numerous offspring of Ea, which is one of the original triad according to their teachings. He held the foremost place. He was originally a form of the sun god. Remember those 25 men worshiping the sun? The sun god was Baal, or Merodach. He was believed to be ever engaged in combating the powers of evil and in performing services for mankind. He's addressed as the redeemer of mankind, the restorer of life, and the raiser from the dead. Tammuz is another form of the sun god, worshipped as the young and beautiful Tammuz, slain by the boar's tusk of winter, and whose death was lamented at the autumnal equinox, the women mourning for Tammuz. What's Tammuz? A form of the sun god. All these were from the nations around about him. There was also the moon god named Sin, and his offspring, according to some of the legends of Babylonia, was the daughter, was Ishtar. Ishtar was the chief of the Akkadian goddesses. She was invoked as the queen of heaven. So you see some of the worshiping of the queen of the heaven. So Judah is worshiping all this idol gods. And where did they come from? They came from the nations around about them, primarily from Assyria and Babylon. You see the influence of these idol gods everywhere. For instance, Jeremiah was from city Anathoth. Where did it get its name? Well, you remember that original triad? The consort of Anu was Anat. And Anathoth is literally the temple of the goddess Anat. Mount Nebo, where Moses stood and looked over the promised land. Where did Nebo get his name? Well, the offspring of Marduk was Nebo. Nebo was called the prophet. Whence names such as Nebuchadnezzar come from? So you see these place names everywhere. So the influence is there. And God told them when he sent them to the land, all these nations of Canaan did this. I am judging them because of that. Don't you do it. Well, what happened to them? You see the influence. Now, why is this significant? If you'll read from 2 Chronicles 32, 10 through 16.
10 through 16?
Yes. This is in context.
Thus says Sennacherib.
Let me give the context first. The context is when Assyria had come down and taken the north, and he came down against Hezekiah. And so he's right there at the city gates, really, yelling to the people. And here's what he says.
Thus says Sennacherib, king of Assyria, in what do you trust that you remain under siege in Jerusalem? Does not Hezekiah persuade you to give yourselves over to die by famine and by thirst, saying, the Lord our God will deliver us from the hand of the king of Assyria? Has not the same Hezekiah taken away his high places and his altars and commanded Judah and Jerusalem, saying, you shall worship before one altar and burn incense on it? Do you not know that I and my fathers have done to all the peoples of other lands? Were the gods of these nations, of those lands, in any way able to deliver their lands out of my hand? Who was there among all the gods of those nations that my fathers utterly destroyed that could deliver his people from my hand, that your God should be able to deliver you from my hand? Now therefore, do not let Hezekiah deceive you or persuade you like this, and do not believe him. For no god of any nation or kingdom was able to deliver his people from my hand or the hand of my fathers. How much less will your God deliver you from my hand? Furthermore, his servant spoke against the Lord God and against his servant Hezekiah.
Them spiking words. Did you notice how challenging it was? He said, look, the hand of my master, we've done away with all the idol gods. None can stand against us. How much less do you think your God can stand? What's the greatest motivator that we see in the Bible for God acting? Have you ever thought about that? What motivates God to act? We know that he works in the nations of men. In fact, what's the theme that Robert gives in his lesson book for the theme of Daniel?
God works in the kingdoms
yeah,
of men.
God works in the nations of the kingdoms of men. That's the theme. And we see that in the book of Daniel. But not just in the book of Daniel, we see it throughout the Bible. What's the number one reason he acts in the nations of men? Ever thought about it? When, think about it this way. When Moses was up on the mountain talking with God, and they looked down and they saw the idol that Aaron had made, what did God say to Moses? Yeah, he said, "You stand out of the way. I will destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation." What did Moses say to God?
"No, don't do that. They will think you're weak."
He said, "What will the Egyptians think? The Egyptians will think you just brought them out here to murder them." In other words, Lord, act that glory may be to your name. That's the number one argument that men have when they come in God's presence and ask him to intervene in the affairs of man. Act for your name's sake. And he does that over and over again. He said to Israel, "I will not destroy you for my name's sake." They had done works worthy of being destroyed as a nation, but he said, "I will not do it for my name's sake, for I will not give my glory to another." And yet, surrounded around Israel are these nations that are making statements like this one from Assyria. And God acts to have 185,000 in a single night slain for his name's sake. Well, we're coming to the time of Babylon. And if you look through Jeremiah, you will see that God says, "I have given all into the hand of Babylon." You see, it wasn't just Judah going into captivity. It was all the nations were being given to be subject to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Israel only, or Judah only fell into that because they had gone over into idols, and so they fell into the same band. God has a controversy with the nations. Why? Because of statements like that. And this one, recorded by in the same book by Sais in Assyria, its princes and prophets and or priests and people. This is a liturgy of Assyria and Babylon, which was to be read on the second day of Nisan, which includes, and this is it, said to Marduk, "O my Lord, who in his strength has no equal, O my Lord, blessed sovereign, Lord of the world, speeding the peace for the great gods, the Lord who in his might destroys the strong, Lord of kings, light of mankind, establisher of trust, O Bel, thy scepter is Babylon, thy crown is Borsippa, the wide heaven is the dwelling place. O Lord of the world, light of the spirits of heavens, utterer of blessings." You think about all those terms, the terms that belong to the one true God. These, again, are fighting words. And why and how is God selling the whole world in the hand of Babylon? Well, remember what king of Assyria said. He said, "All these gods are worth nothing because I've been able to take them." So under Babylon, all the gods of the world would be shown to be nothing. And then Marduk himself would fall. He would be taken. Why is God doing this? He's discrediting all the idols. So this is not just about Judah going into captivity. It's about discrediting the idols. Why? Because God has a controversy with the nations. In Jeremiah 25, he says, "Prophesy against all these words and say to them, the Lord will roar from on high and utter his voice from his holy habitation." Well, God really hadn't been quiet. He had been speaking. The psalm says, "The heavens declare the glory of God. There is no nation or language where his voice is not heard." But this roaring is because of judgment. "He will roar mightily. He will give a shout as those who tread the grapes." Against who? Judah? No. All the inhabitants of the earth. What's the great controversy? Well, the noise will come from the ends of the earth, but the Lord has a controversy with the nations. He will plead his case with all flesh. God is not just concerned with Judah. He's concerned with the whole world. Judah fell into the same trap that the nations around them did, and so they faced judgment. But the controversy here is with nations. Why? Because of the statements of the king of Assyria, statements of the priests of Merodach and others. This is the bigger picture. God is concerned about all the people of the world. And of course, today, where are the idols? They have been thoroughly discredited, haven't they? God has been successful, I believe. That doesn't turn men always back to him. Here's his argument. This is the passage in Psalms that I was talking about. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. There's no speech or language, or their voice is not heard. Here's his argument in Jeremiah 27:6. Now I've given all these lands in the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, and all nations will serve him until the time of his land comes, and then many nations and great kings will make him serve them. And so even Merodach would be discredited. In the middle of this, you've got Judah. In Isaiah, he said, you're my witnesses. Have I not told you from that time and declared that you are my witnesses? Is there a God besides me? No other rock, I know not one. Those who make an image, all of them are useless, and their precious things shall not profit. They are their own witnesses. They neither see nor know, that they may be ashamed. So this is his actions in the nations of men. He is working to discredit all these things that men trust in. This is the actions as a result of the controversy. So there's the context, religious and political. And here's Daniel in the first wave. And of course, you know the first thing that happens. And we'll get into that Wednesday night. How does he react when serving before a king who worships idols? It's a tough situation, isn't it? Kind of like some situations we might face as Christians when we're trying to uphold honesty and integrity, and we go to work for someone who maybe not be as honest as we would like or have the integrity. Do we go along to get along, or do we stand up and be counted? Challenging times are coming for Daniel. Second half of lesson one, the intro that Robert gives, is based on objections. And so I want to deal with that for a few minutes. Why is that important? Daniel has some significant prophecies. Very significant prophecies. They are faith-building prophecies. The atheist does not believe them. And so he has to have it come up with a reason for not believing them. So there are several objections. I'll cover some that Robert has and a couple maybe that he doesn't have. Here's one. Liberal theologians claim the book had to be written about 165 B.C. We pretty know that it had to be available by then because, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls can be well dated easily. And they had copies of Daniel. So there's hard evidence that they were extant from that date. It fits the liberal theologians' point of view, because he can say that, well, by that time, all this was history. And Daniel's not predicting the future, he's just telling what happened in history. If we as Christians cave into that idea, here are the consequences. If we can't accept Daniel as being true, we can't accept Ezekiel either, for he says that in his time frame, Daniel was known. Where he talks about the wickedness of the city, and even if it had these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, God still wouldn't preserve it. Ezekiel wrote to the prince of Tyre, and with a little sarcasm, "Are you wiser than Daniel?" So his fame was known. Even Jesus talked about the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So if we can't accept Daniel as a prophet, guess what? We can't accept Christ as Jesus as Christ either. It falls apart. All of it does. So it's a significant thing. It's not just a minor point. These objections are very serious. Here's one objection. Liberal theologians claim that two authors wrote the book based upon the fact that Daniel 2 verse 4 through chapter 7 and 28 is written in Aramaic. And this one's from your book, while the rest is written in Hebrew. And of course, they argue that this was late Aramaic until the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered and they found out that Daniel's Aramaic wasn't the same as that which was extant in 165 B.C. But the answer is that Daniel uses most languages, doesn't really prove two authors, even more than it's evidence that there was two authors, because there's two distinct styles in the book either. In fact, the two sections don't really correlate. They overlap. In other words, chapters 1 through 6 are primarily history, 7 through 12 are primarily apocalyptic or prophetic. And it's not as though these were all in Aramaic and these were all in Hebrew, no. The Hebrew and Aramaic overlap between these two sections, which is further evidence that it was a single author. Robert's got a couple of arguments in his book about language. So if you look on the book, page 4, item C, liberal theologians claim the use of the Greek words in Daniel 3:5, such as harp, psaltery, and dulcimer, proves that it was written at a later time in the Greek period. And these are, you know, it's not a good argument because those names are just borrowed from another language, just like we borrow from other languages all the time. It's just not a good argument. Number two, they claim the use of the 15-year-old Persian words, such as princes and the king's meat, indicate a later date. No, they only prove that Daniel's life touched the Persian kingdom as well. As we look at the book, and we talk about these two sections that you can divide the book into, chapters 1 through 6 and 7 through 12, look at where they fit on the timeline. The first six chapters really are when Daniel was a young man. These are approximate ages that I put in. We don't really know the age of Daniel. That's a controversial thing. It says he was a young man. How old was a young man? Could be 18, 20, 25 maybe. So if you start with 15, and I argue that because the Babylonians wouldn't train a man like Daniel in their ways unless he was trainable. Men get to be 25 and they're not as trainable as they are at 15. But at any rate, look at the ages. He was a young man. Then there's a huge gap of like 33 years. Chapter 7 through 12 were all written much, much later. Anybody here ever written anything when they were 20 and wrote something when they were 70? Were they different? Yeah. Yeah. So, the fact that they are in different style doesn't mean a different writer. But it is a different age, and you can see that from the context of the book itself. So when you look at the book, there's two major divisions, the first six chapters and then the rest of the book. And you can see why it might be in a different style. Why Aramaic and why Hebrew? Well, the prophecies are mostly in Hebrew because they're written primarily to the Hebrew people. Aramaic was kind of a regional language. The Assyrians would understand it. The Babylonians would understand it. And so the first six chapters, a significant portion of it, is written in Aramaic. Why? I believe it may well have been a testimony for all those around him. Remember what God said to Judah through Isaiah. He said, "You are my witnesses." Daniel just wasn't writing off and side and hiding it. He was fairly open about his belief in God. He was one of God's witnesses. Here's an interesting website. If you want to read about the objections, and there are many, and some of the arguments are difficult, this is actually an anti-Christian website. It's called the Skeptical Review Online. And I point you to it, theskepticalreview.com, because it has a debate that occurred, was documented in 1998, so fairly recent, within the last 15 years, between Farrell Till, who maintains that Daniel was written about 165 B.C., and Everett Hatcher III, which propounds the traditional view that Daniel was a prophet. And you can see this actual article here is a critic's admission by Everett Hatcher III, dated 1998. Farrell Till says, in kind of his lead-off, this is the quote from Farrell Till that Everett Hatcher makes in this article. Remember, Farrell Till is against the traditional view. He's a liberal theologian. He takes the position in his article. He quotes William Sirix, Jr., Daniel in the Historian's Den, and he comments, "Daniel can't get Babylonian history straight, but he does pretty well by the Hellenistic era. Obviously, whoever wrote the book was a very solid citizen of the 2nd century B.C., whose prophecies were wholly retroactive." there's an interesting implicit acknowledgement here. One is, if the atheist agrees with 165, there's still one prophecy in Daniel that is unrefuted. And that's the prophecy of the 70 weeks, which we'll get into. And that's an exciting prophecy because it's still nearly 200 years in the future when even the latest date that the skeptic agrees to. So there's some tremendous prophetic witness, even if you accepted the liberal theologian's view. Well, how does Everett Hatcher answer that? He says, the fourth admission by the critics concerns the term Chaldeans. And this has to do with history. Daniel uses the word Chaldeans two ways. Jeffries argues the use of the word Chaldeans was not in the proper ethnic sense when it has, for example, in Jeremiah, used to mean a caste of wise men, and it points to a time when the word was commonly used for a class of priestly astrologers, diviners, or magicians, a sense the word has in the pages of Diodorus Siculus, who wrote in the first century, 349 BC. Look at that. Dr. Driver argues that the argument concerning the use of the term Chaldeans is very convincing, so much that he places it first in the list of his three strongest arguments that show that the book of Daniel was not composed in Palestine during the persecution of Antiochus Epiphanes. So these are the objections, that the word Chaldeans used to talk about the wise men was not in use in the time of Daniel, that it was later. Here's the response. And it's interesting here, in his response, he's quoting some discoveries that occurred not just really recently, but quite a few years ago. How strong is this argument about the use of the word Chaldeans? On page 12 of Dr. Driver's comments, Driver himself takes exceptions to some of the assertions made by Jeffrey. Driver admits that in Daniel 5 and 9:1, Daniel used the ethnic sense of the word Chaldeans. And then on the same page, Driver admits this term Chaldeans is found in Herodotus, dated 440 BC, quite a bit earlier, a lot closer to the time of Daniel, and is common afterwards in the classical writers. Furthermore, Driver also admits that evidence indicates that such a group of wise men as pictured in the book of Daniel did exist as a group as early as 2000 BC. And so Schaefer summarizes Driver's argument. Remember, this is his first strong argument. He's going to date the book of Daniel and throw away historical data on the basis of these so-called strong arguments. And this is the first one. And we define this question in regard to the term Chaldeans. The writer knew the ethnic sense, and this group, as a group of wise men, did exist from a long time before. And about 90 years later, everybody acknowledges that the word was used in the sense to the wise man. You see how weak the argument is. Okay? And that's the kind of back and forth you're going to see if you read through the debates. And I've read through them, and they're pretty good. If you really want to understand the issues, go get this series of debates between Farrell Till and Everett Hatcher. You can just Google Farrell Till and Everett Hatcher, and it'll take you to them. Here's another objection real quick because I'm going to run out of time. The title King of Persians, interesting. Jeffrey makes a similar error in his commentary on Daniel 10:1. He states Cyrus is here called King of Persia. This may be merely a statement of fact, for he was King of Persia, but if it was meant as an official title, it's an anachronism in the mouth of Daniel. In other words, he was never known by that title. That's his argument. But Jeffrey overlooked the fact that Robert Dick Wilson contradicted this view expressly with what he found in the tablets of the Persian period, and look at the date on that. 1917. Wilson commented, it is evident, therefore, that there are 38 distinct extra-biblical instances of this use of the title King of Persia from 545 to 400 BC, and that these instances are found in 20 different works of 19 different persons. So is it an anachronism in the mouth of Daniel to refer to the King of Persia as a title? Not at all. And so over and over again, you have the skeptic arguing, this can't be true. Why? Because his back's up against the wall. If he admits that it's true, you've got all this prophetic evidence to say that Daniel is truly a prophet of God. But even if you accepted all the words of the atheist, there's still the 70 weeks prophecy that's really exciting, I think. Good evidence. So Daniel is a significant book and holds significant things for us as we look at this controversy that God has with the nations and how Daniel is going to be a witness in the midst of all that controversy. I thank you for your time. I think our